Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today we're reading from the August 29th, 2025 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like a war scene. Ukraine. There's missiles flying over there overhead. There's bombs exploding. But in the foreground, in the middle of the street, is a conference table. Sitting across from each other are Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky, both with their arms crossed and stern looks on their faces. At the head of the table is a smiling Donald Trump, giving us a two thumbs up signal. The headline is Mission Impossible, Why Trump's Ukraine Peace Talks Are Going Nowhere. That is our first main story, and we will start with that. Pomp but little progress at Trump's Ukraine talks. A meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska, and a White House summit with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and seven European leaders left Trump seemingly no closer to a deal to end the Ukraine war this week, with the Kremlin rebuffing his call for direct peace talks between Putin and Zelensky, and Ukraine rejecting Moscow's demand that it surrender a vast swath of territory. In a show of support for Zelensky, whose last visit to the White House ended in a blow-up with Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, European leaders, including Prime Minister Keir Starmer, French President Emmanuel Macron, and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, converged on the White House for his meeting with Trump. The U.S. President greeted Zelensky and the Europeans warmly and pledged that the U.S. would be involved in security guarantees sought by Ukraine as part of any deal. He later clarified that U.S. support would be limited to air power, with Europe putting people on the ground. But Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said any discussion of security guarantees without the Russian Federation is a utopia, a road to nowhere. At the Alaska summit with Putin, Trump made numerous shows of deference to the accused war criminal. He rolled out a red carpet and applauded as Putin walked it, had fighter jets fly overhead, and planned a luncheon in honor of His Excellency, which Putin snubbed. Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the display vomit-inducing. To secure a peace deal, Putin said Ukraine would have to surrender its entire eastern Donbass region, including areas still under Ukrainian control. Ukraine's constitution bars the surrender of land except through a national referendum. After the meeting, Trump put the onus on Ukraine to make concessions, saying Zelensky can end the war almost immediately if he wants to. Following the White House summit, Trump said he'd call Putin to begin arrangements for a meeting between the Russian leader and Zelensky. In comments to Macron captured on a hot mic, Trump expressed optimism, saying of Putin, "I think he wants to make a deal for me." But Lavrov dismissively referred to Zelensky as this character and said any meeting would have to be reached step by step, gradually. It's possible, Trump told Fox News, that Putin doesn't want to make a deal. What the editorials said. With their show of solidarity and some skillful Trump flattery, Zelensky and his European allies averted a diplomatic disaster, said the Financial Times. The leaders flew en masse to Washington for fear Trump would railroad Zelensky into a bad deal or punish him for rejecting one. That dire scenario was avoided, but Trump still abandoned his pre-Alaska stance that Russia must sign an immediate ceasefire. And it's far from clear the Kremlin will agree to his touted sit-down. But in Trump's peacemaking show, optics matter more than substance. The summit did yield some good news, said the Wall Street Journal. Trump's first assertion that the U.S. will help provide security guarantees to Ukraine. That's important. A deal without a credible deterrent will result in Putin restarting the war after he's rearmed. Trump offered no specifics, and the details will matter. But his pledge to offer a lot of help was a welcome sign that he understands what it will take to gain a durable peace and that America has a strong interest in a stable Europe. What the columnist said. The Alaska spectacle was an embarrassment, said Harlan Ullman in The Hill. He invited the autocratic thug, under warrant for war crimes, onto U.S. soil, greeted him affectionately, and pulled him into his presidential car for a ride. Trump couldn't comprehend that this chummy display would not have any effect on Putin. When they made their post-meeting appearance, where no agreement was announced, Trump appeared old, tired, and deflated, and mumbled about Russiagate. Putin, meanwhile, appeared emboldened, holding forth on the primary causes of a conflict wrought by his own naked aggression. Putin's proposed Donbass land grab is something Zelensky can't possibly accept, said Kathy Young in The Bulwark, for both military and political reasons. Any shift in borders would have to be approved by a referendum, and despite war weariness, more than 80% of Ukrainians reject ceding territory to Russia, and the Donetsk region includes heavily fortified defensive positions. Surrendering them would open the way to a new Russia attack that Putin would stage sooner or later. Despite the flurry of diplomatic action, it's easy to overlook that nothing meaningful has changed in the war, said Andreas Kluth in Bloomberg. Even as hands were shaken in D.C., Putin continued to bomb civilians, detain children, and otherwise terrorize a sovereign nation. The diplomatic spectacles played out like reality TV, not quite substantive, but always performative. As we watched the show unfold, the war Trump once promised to end in 24 hours raged on, with Ukrainians bleeding, crying, and dying at Putin's hand. Trump's desire to end the bloodshed is commendable, said Thomas L. Friedman in the New York Times. Less so is the seat-of-the-pants, often farcical way he is going about it. Even worse, it seems clear Trump, desperate for a Nobel Peace Prize, doesn't get what the Ukraine war is truly about. He doesn't get that Putin, still smoldering from the breakup of the Soviet Union, is out to break up the West. He doesn't get that Putin is no friend, but a cold-blooded murderer. And even though 1.4 million Russian and Ukrainian soldiers have been killed or wounded to satisfy Putin's fevered dreams of restoring the Russian Empire, Trump still doesn't understand that Putin wants not peace, but victory. The controversy of the week. America, are we now living in an autocracy? On the campaign trail last year, Donald Trump famously promised to not govern as a dictator, except for day one. We're now past day 200, said David Smith in The Guardian, and the president's authoritarian project is only expanding. These bleak 7 months have seen him install partisan loyalists at every level of government and purge dissenters, make chilling public attacks on any rogue judge who dares challenge his lawless policies, deploy masked ICE agents to snatch people off the streets, and transform the FBI and Justice Department into his personal police force, launching investigations into his critics and political foes. In July, he sent troops into Democratic-run Los Angeles. Now he's doing the same in blue Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, he continues to engage in an Orwellian rewriting of reality, said the Philadelphia Inquirer in an editorial. Officials who accurately report bad economic news have been fired. Government websites have been scrubbed of data on climate change and other non-verboten issues. And mentions in a Smithsonian exhibit of Trump's impeachments were removed and reinstated with heavy edits. It's still hard to believe this is happening, but the authoritarian remaking of U.S. democracy is almost complete. We knew Trump would try this, said Tim Dickinson in Rolling Stone. The shock has been watching American institutions play ball. Whether it's universities, law firms, and media companies settling Trump's bogus lawsuits for millions of dollars in de facto protection money, or tech titans showering him with praise and donations, forces that could have resisted Trump's power grab chose instead to roll over and leave us on a glide path to fascism. Just as pathetic, if more predictable, has been the abject acquiescence of the GOP-controlled Congress, said Aaron Blake in CNN.com. Republicans have looked on silently as Trump has neutered their constitutional power to set taxes and duties by slapping tariffs on trading partners. Lawmakers have the power to rein him in, but don't dare to defy their party's standard bearer. We're in a dark place, said Chris Saliza in his Substack newsletter. But it's too soon to say democracy is collapsing. Trump may be unique in the ferocity of his norm breaking, but most presidents have stretched the rubber band of democracy, and that band has stayed intact and regained something of its former shape after the president leaves office. For Trump, the snapback could start much sooner, said Matt Bai in the Washington Post. The MAGA base will never desert him. But if inflation alienates centrists and conservatives who support him despite his strongman posturing, Trump's poll numbers will plummet, and our now spineless institutions could find their backbones pretty quickly. By the laws of political gravity, that should be how this ends, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. But fascists, by definition, are exempt from those laws. Whatever happens to the economy or Trump's poll numbers, the system he and the GOP are building, in which all sectors of society ultimately comply with the leader's wishes, is not designed to be handed over to a Democrat. A critical mass of the American people supports that project, said Andrew Sullivan in the Weekly Dish. The Republic could have survived Trump himself. What we may not survive are those tens of millions of Americans who are sick of unpredictable elections, sick of the slowness of the change democracy delivers, and more than anything, sick of sharing power with those they despise. Here's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for survivors. After Guinness World Records formally recognized Pearl of Little Elm, Texas, as the planet's oldest living chicken. En route to the record-setting age of 14, Pearl overcame a broken leg, chicken pox, a raccoon attack, says owner Sonia Hull, noting that Pearl now lives in her laundry room, where she enjoys cuddling up with a mop. It was a good week for redos after a judge in Georgia, having just told a defendant that the jury had found him guilty of murder, was perplexed by the reaction in the courtroom. After inquiring, "Didn't I say not?" and being told that he didn't, the judge clarified what he'd meant was to say not guilty, which triggered cheers and hugs at the defense table. And it was a good week for kids today, after the Cambridge Dictionary added 6,000 new words, including skibidi, with its origins in Skibidi Toilet, a surreal YouTube series. Skibidi is a fluid adjective that can mean either cool or bad. But it was a bad week for learning from the past. After Stephanie Donegan, a GOP candidate for a seat in Georgia's state Senate, shared a poorly researched video online claiming most slaves in America were actually white. And President Trump released a statement urging the Smithsonian Museums to stop focusing on how bad slavery was. It's a bad week for hardware. After Starbucks asked remote working customers in South Korea to stop bringing desktop computers, printers, extension cords, and desk dividers into its coffee shops. Laptops and smaller devices, said a spokesman, are welcome. Finally, it was a bad week for cushioning the blow. After Australia's University of Technology, Sydney, advised 400 soon-to-be laid-off staff to manage their distress by baking a dessert, starting a tea ritual, or tackling a task they've been dreading, like washing delicates. The title of this week's briefing, The Hermit Kingdom's Laptop Warriors. American firms are unwittingly hiring IT workers with a second job as North Korean operatives. What is North Korea doing? It has dispatched thousands of homegrown IT specialists to pose online as U.S.-based remote workers and get tech jobs at American companies, often working from China or Russia, where the internet is more reliable than in North Korea. The imposters apply for gigs as app developers, software engineers, and tech consultants. Individual operatives often work multiple jobs and earn up to $300,000 a year, 90% to 95% of which is sent back to the regime of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, according to the U.S. government. The computer activity of these workers is under constant digital surveillance by Pyongyang. If they search for sexually explicit material or for news reports on Kim, their activity is flagged to the regime. Experts believe that thousands of U.S. firms have unwittingly hired North Koreans, ranging from mom-and-pop firms to blue-chip juggernauts. Charles Carmichael, chief technology officer at the Google-owned cybersecurity provider Mandiant, said earlier this year that nearly every Fortune 500 information security chief he's talked to has admitted they've hired at least one North Korean IT worker, and sometimes dozens of them. If you're an American company that's hired contract IT workers over the past few years, said Michael Barnhart, an investigator at cybersecurity company DTEX, you've probably hired a North Korean. How do the workers get hired? It starts on job networking sites like LinkedIn, where the operatives create fake profiles for American job seekers, often using stolen identities. At the interview stage, the North Koreans use AI tools to help them answer questions in English in real time, mimic an American accent, or alter their face on screen. Those tools later help the workers with office small talk, suggesting Thanksgiving greetings or explaining American football rules. Once hired, the operative will ask for their work laptop to be sent to the address of a U.S.-based middleman who installs remote access tools so the North Koreans can access the company's network from outside the country. These U.S.-based laptop farms often host dozens of devices used by numerous operatives. Who runs the farms? Typically, Americans in need of extra income. The FBI found 90 laptops when it raided Christina Chapman's house outside Phoenix in October 2023. Over 3 years, the former waitress had helped North Koreans illegally collect $17.1 million from more than 300 companies, including Nike, a premier Silicon Valley tech firm and one of the most recognizable media and entertainment companies in the world, said prosecutors. Chapman earned $177,000 for the service and was sentenced last month to 8 years in prison. She said she was recruited on LinkedIn by a China-based firm and didn't know she was aiding North Korea. Why does the regime need this cash? Because it's been shut off from much of the global economy since 2006, when the country conducted its first nuclear test. Hit with crippling international sanctions, Pyongyang looked for new ways to fund the ruling Kim family regime and its nuclear weapons program. Under Kim Jong-il, the totalitarian government expanded its drug trafficking operations, setting up industrial-sized meth labs inside North Korea and shipping the product overseas. But when he died in 2011 and was succeeded by his son, Kim Jong-un, the dictatorship diversified into cybercrime, using hacker soldiers recruited from the country's IT-focused universities to steal cash and valuable data from major banks, businesses, cryptocurrency exchanges, and government databases. And the boom in remote work during the pandemic gave North Korea another valuable revenue stream to tap. Has the remote worker scheme been successful? Very. It generates somewhere between $250 million and $600 million a year for North Korea, according to UN estimates. That's a major chunk of revenue for one of the world's poorest and most economically isolated countries. And the money often keeps rolling in even after operatives are discovered and dismissed by their U.S. employers. The North Korean workers routinely install malicious software inside company networks, allowing them to hold sensitive data and intelligence hostage or lock down a business's computer system entirely until a ransom is paid. This is very adaptive, said FBI agent Elizabeth Pelker. Even if the hacker knows they're going to get fired at some point, they have an exit strategy. Is the U.S. trying to counter the North Korean threat? Over the past year, the FBI has arrested multiple American citizens accused of running laptop farms and charged numerous North Korean operatives based overseas. The U.S. last month placed sanctions on Song Kum-hyuk, a member of Kim's military intelligence agency, who in 2022 began choreographing the mass theft of names, social security numbers, and other personal information from Americans to create aliases for the remote workers. The Treasury Department also sanctioned Gaik Astrarian, a Russian businessman accused of signing a 10-year contract with Pyongyang in 2024 to host up to 80 North Korean IT workers in Russia. Adam Myers, a counter-adversary expert at cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, said the crackdown by law enforcement has put a big dent in North Korea's ability to operate laptop farms in the U.S., but that doesn't mean the threat will disappear, only move. As it gets increasingly expensive or difficult to get remote jobs here in the U.S., they're pivoting to other locations, said Myers. They're getting more traction in Europe. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Hegseth's patriarchal purge. Pete Hegseth is imposing a Christian nationalist patriarchy on the military, said Jeet here. The Fox News personality turned Secretary of Defense has been more concentrated on defeating liberalism than in fighting foreign wars. And that agenda includes purging the military leadership of women officers. Hegseth recently removed Vice Admiral Yvette Davids as head of the Naval Academy and previously removed the first woman to command the Navy and the first woman to command the Coast Guard as well as other women in senior leadership posts. All were replaced by white males. It's not surprising, given that Hegseth is a fervent follower of an arch-conservative evangelical church whose stated agenda is to remake the U.S. as an overtly Christian nation and to restore traditional gender roles and female subservience. Hegseth recently retweeted a video of Pastor Doug Wilson advocating Christian nationalism and the statement, "All of Christ for all of life." Wilson has also said that giving women the right to vote was a bad idea. Hegseth himself has written that many of the 225,000 women in uniform are there because of liberal social engineering. In Hegseth's military, you are automatically suspect if you are a woman, trans, or a person of color. The lethal impact of polluted air. Unlike floods and heat waves, air pollution doesn't lend itself to morbid doom scrolling or panicked media coverage, said Lisa Featherstone. But bad air is actually much more deadly than the more obvious consequences of climate change. The World Health Organization estimates that the annual death toll from air pollution is about 7 million people, far more than from storms, floods, and heat waves. Inhaling toxins and tiny bits of soot day after day increases people's risk of emphysema, chronic bronchitis, asthma, breast cancer, lymphoma, lung cancer, and coronary disease. There is also evidence that it takes a toll on mental health. In this hotter world, massive wildfires have covered major U.S. cities in California, the Midwest, and the Northeast in heavy toxin-laden smoke that can penetrate deep into the lungs. Yet perversely, the Trump administration recently announced it will move to repeal the Obama-era endangerment finding, which enables the government to use the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The White House also exempted 100 major companies that produce the most carcinogenic chemicals known to man from the same law. These shameless deregulation schemes may go unnoticed, even as they kill many more of us. This column comes from South Africa. Hunters are part of our ecosystem. When an American trophy hunter was gored to death by a charging Cape buffalo earlier this month, animal rights activists openly rejoiced, said Ed Stoddard. The beast's revenge was poetic justice for Texas millionaire Asher Watkins, they argued, since, after all, he was trying to blow the buffalo away for sport. I understand that lots of people deplore hunting, and plenty who don't mind hunting in general dislike trophy hunting. But celebrating a man's death is grotesque. Hunters, even trophy hunters, are not the enemy of conservation here in South Africa. Studies show they don't kill enough of any species to make the slightest dent in animal populations. And their money supports reserves for endangered animals. There is, though, a mountain of evidence that photo safari tourism, also known as non-consumptive tourism, has a massive ecological footprint. The big resorts, built to accommodate game watchers, tend to have more roads and amenities than hunting lodges, and the tourists themselves often behave much less respectfully. Just last month, vehicles packed with camera-toting tourists swarmed a riverbank in Tanzania to watch the wildebeest migration and ended up blocking the poor animals from crossing. Those who celebrate Watkins' death are examples of the dark side of animal rights activism and the callousness and ignorance that drives much of it. And time for the last word, our feature article, A Second Exile. Reza Zavar fled Iran for America at age 12, said Aaron Cox in the Washington Post. 40 years later, the U.S. wants to deport him. It just doesn't know where. Sharp knocks on the front door interrupted Firuza Firuzabadi's Saturday morning coffee. On the porch of her suburban Maryland home were two law enforcement agencies and a very familiar pit bull mix named Duke. "Can you take this dog?" Firuzabadi recalled one of the men saying. I said, "This is my son's dog. Where is he?" They wouldn't say. At that moment, her son, Riza Zavar, was handcuffed in the back of an SUV parked two houses down in the Gaithersburg neighborhood where the Iranian-born family has lived since 2009. Apprehended, he later said, that late June day by at least five federal immigration agents in tactical gear who told Zavar they had been waiting for him to take Duke out for his regular morning walk. More than a month later, Zavar, 52, remains in U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody, part of a surge of arrests of immigrants with standing court orders barring their deportation to their native countries. The Trump administration has increasingly turned to sending people to third countries. In court papers, ICE said it plans to send Zavar to Australia or Romania. Zavar left Tehran alone when he was 12, arriving in Virginia in 1985 on a student visa secured by his parents as a way to escape conscription into the Iranian army. He eventually received U.S. asylum and then a green card. His family joined him and they settled in Maryland. But in his 20s, Zavar's guilty pleas in two misdemeanor marijuana possession cases jeopardized his immigration status. In 2007, an immigration judge issued a withholding of removal order, determining it was unsafe for Zavar to return to Iran. He built a life, went to college, and has been working as a white-collar recruiter for a consulting firm. But shortly after the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear facilities on June 22nd, the Trump administration began publicizing enforcement against Iranian nationals, people with and without criminal convictions. The Department of Homeland Security highlighted the arrest of 11 Iranian nationals whose records included drug charges, convictions of child abuse or gun crimes, along with allegations that one was a former Iranian army sniper and that another had ties to the terrorist group Hezbollah. The agency also detained a married Iranian couple who are Louisiana State University students with pending U.S. asylum applications, arrested in June after a ruse led them to waiting ICE agents. Now, President Donald Trump's ramped up immigration enforcement has left families like Zavar's with what feels like a random and sudden disappearance. Vanessa Dohakis Torres, counsel at the nonprofit American Immigration Lawyers Association, said the organization's 18,000 members have reported a rapid expansion of clients being similarly detained, shifting the role of such withholding of removal orders from a protection against deportation into a tool for delivering one. The federal statute that created those withholding orders, passed by Congress in the 1990s, under the International Convention Against Torture, allows deportation to a third country, but it has rarely happened. On paper, it had always been a possibility. The government could use such orders to deport someone to a third country, Dohakis Torres said, but this is the first time it's happened on such a large scale. Everyone else in the family besides Riza became U.S. citizens 3 decades ago, his mother said. Firuzabadi, 73, stays at home most days, strategizing how to deal with an upended life. "Just why?" she asked from her living room recently, Duke at her feet. "I just hope no mother experiences this. The unknown is killing me." In a plain manila folder, she keeps everything Zavar's family and friends gathered as their evidence he belongs in the United States. She flips through photos as if auditioning which best demonstrates his worthiness to strangers. A smiling boy in Tehran, or on the high school football team one town over from where they live now. Maybe with her, pinning something to his chest at the 8th grade graduation from the military boarding school in Virginia that sponsored his first visa back in 1985. Firuz Abadi said her son's sudden absence awoke a grief she had known since her husband, Zavar's father, died of an aggressive pancreatic cancer in 1997. Zavar was 24. He became the man of the house, she said. I don't want to compare that situation to this, but I am going through the same thing. Devastation, she said. In May, Zavar and Duke left behind a nearby apartment and moved into the family home to help his mom and uncle care for his grandmother, who, at 94, had dementia. Zavar insisted on the move, his mother says, after she called him to quickly come over and lift up the older woman after a fall. Firuz Abadi smiled as she said he also calms her down when the frustrations of dealing with dementia boil over. That's why he's my backbone, she said. We need to convince the authorities that, hey, he's a pure American boy, said his older sister, Miriam Zavar, who spells her Americanized last name differently than her brother. He's been here since he was 12, the past 40 years, his sister continued. All his family's here. We're all here. We're not going anywhere. Zavar was the first person in his immediate family to move to the United States. In 1985, his parents secured a student visa and enrolled him at Linton Hall Military School in Northern Virginia. The family said it paid $28,000 for Zavar's 7th and 8th grade schooling, a way to spare him from being conscripted into the Iranian army during the height of the conservative Islamic regime's 8-year war with Iraq. They were trying to save him, his sister said. Zavar spoke only Farsi, but he knew the English word car and already had a love of the Washington area's football team. His father had fallen for the team, now called the Commanders, when he was a student in the U.S. in the late 1960s, and he exported the fandom to Tehran when he returned there, Miriam Zavar said. Firuz Abadi immigrated from Iran 2 years after Zavar, leaving her daughter and husband behind for a few years. She enrolled her son at Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland, and applied for his green card. She got her first job ever in a department store, learned English, and became a U.S. citizen in the mid-1990s. After graduation in his 20s, Zavar faced legal trouble a few times. In 1994, he pleaded guilty to possession of a controlled substance in Maryland, paid a $100 fine for the marijuana-related charge, and served a year's probation, according to court records. In 1998, he pleaded guilty to attempted possession of marijuana in D.C. and paid a $50 fine. Separately, in 1996, a female acquaintance asked a judge for a civil protective order against him. The court, which classified the request as a domestic violence dispute, denied it. No criminal charges were filed. In 2004, Zavar spent 5 months in Iran trying to sell the Tehran home in which he grew up, his family said. When he returned to the U.S., immigration agents at Dulles International Airport noticed that the FBI had flagged the cannabis charges, which ultimately triggered deportation proceedings that stretched for 3 years, according to court records. Unlike now, Zavar, during that time, had been granted bail and was free to live and work in the U.S. until the case was resolved in 2007, with a judge issuing an order barring his removal to Iran. Now, that same order is the basis of the Trump administration's claim that Zavar should be deported, just not to Iran, and its argument that he should have chosen to settle in another country. Zavar had almost 20 years to self-deport and leave the U.S., said Tricia McLaughlin, a DHS spokeswoman. Until recently, the U.S. government rarely tried to deport people to countries where they were not citizens or recent residents. An American Immigration Council analysis of data from the 2017 fiscal year, for example, found that 1.6% of the 1,274 people granted withholding of removal orders that year were deported to third countries. They weren't going to just roll up on some guy walking his dog in the suburbs, Zavar's lawyer, Ava Banach, said about how ICE previously treated such orders. In this case, the agency used the order to detain Zavar in the Texas facility for more than a month. He has since been moved to Ohio. The idea that I may have to go to Texas about the deportation of an Iranian man to Romania is something I have never contemplated in 30 years of immigration law, she said. It's just so far outside the bounds of anticipated reality that it's hard to get your head around. Firouz Abadi has tried to visualize her son's experience, but all the images she conjured were just scenes from the Orange is the New Black TV show he used to tease her for watching, she said. Every day of his detention in Texas, Zavar calls briefly from the dorms. He brushes off his mom's questions about conditions there. She hasn't mentioned she's lost 10 pounds. She cajoles him to meditate, warns him to conduct himself safely, and threatens to put Duke up for adoption if he doesn't listen to her advice. I keep telling Risa, maybe something good comes out of it, and you use this quiet time for you, she said. He and his sister didn't tell their mother. He once abruptly ended a call when a fight broke out, telling his sister, I have to go sit in a corner and not get caught up in it. He urges his mom to rejoin the Persian singing group she's been skipping. He tells her to find a way to have fun. Firouz Abadi's been turning down her friend's offers to get out of the house, she said. I feel like if I leave home, I'm losing control, she said. What if he calls? As she spoke, a robotic voice on her cell phone announced, Unknown caller. That's him, she said. Duke perked up when she put Zavar on speakerphone. My only fear is that they will wrongfully deport me at any second without letting my lawyer know, or anybody else, and send me to a third country that I don't know, Zavar said in a pay-by-the-minute call from Texas. He said he noticed a beige sedan with tinted windows parked on his block that June morning, a few seconds before a man wearing ICE police body armor stepped out of it, asking if his dog was friendly. As more agents surrounded him, he said, I kept asking him, why are you guys doing this? And they wouldn't answer me. He said he wished he'd applied for citizenship when he was younger, but it seemed like something he would get to eventually. He said he didn't know 27 years ago that pleading guilty to cannabis charges could trigger a deportation and make him ineligible for citizenship. The judge didn't tell him, and he didn't have a lawyer then, he said. In the detention dorm, he plays cards or chess with a handful of other Iranian men. He tries to walk around and watches the news. He said he talks with as many people as possible about the circumstances, taking notes and writing about his experiences. I get a little bit of what they're trying to do, he said of the Trump administration, but I think how they're going about it is wrong. It's kind of like going out to sea and trying to fish for a certain type of fish and throwing a wide net into it and just gathering up every kind of fish, and then, in time, sorting through them and to see what fish they can find. He said he sleeps during the early half of the day, when it's slightly quieter. I miss silence. I haven't had any silence in 3 weeks. It's constant noise in this place. After he hung up, Firouz Abadi cried. She said she tries to visualize his return. She sees him dropping to the living room carpet to play with Duke, the hug she'll give him, the party she'll throw in his driveway, the slap she'll deliver for all the trouble he caused. His bare-bones studio apartment in the basement is how he left it. Every night, Duke sleeps on his bed. Every morning, she goes down and remakes it, just in case. A version of this story was originally published in the Washington Post. Here's one of the technology articles for you. Broken Brains, the Social Price of Digital Life. Smartphones and streaming services seem likely culprits in a catastrophic loss of life skills among younger Americans, said John Byrne Murdoch in the Financial Times. Troubling new data from the University of Southern California's Understanding America study show that adults in their 20s and 30s have grown increasingly careless, easily distracted, and less eager to honor commitments. Conscientiousness, the quality of being dependable and disciplined, in particular, is in free fall among people ages 16 to 39, but other measures of the ability to get along with others are falling too. Since 2017, neuroticism has jumped while agreeableness and extroversion have dropped. More Americans say they are easily distracted, and fewer think they are helpful or outgoing. After all the time we spend online, real-life commitments now feel messy and effortful. Even our sense of time is getting warped by social media, impairing both short-term and long-term memory, said Gerwinder Bogal in the Free Press. Chances are you can't remember any of the posts you saw in your feed, even if you scroll for hours. This is because attention engineers have designed the interfaces and algorithms so that the feeds resemble casinos, never-ending mazes of shiny posts and videos that hypnotize you into passivity. A social media feed is like the Lethe, the mystical river where lost souls sought absolution and received it in the form of oblivion. If you need hard evidence of how this is playing out in the real world, said Colby Hall in Mediate, just go to any public park and witness the vast majority of people staring at their phones. No, the kids are not all right, said Sidney Sylvester in U.S. News and World Report, but it's awfully easy to just blame smartphones and social media for society's ill. The idea that social media is responsible for declining mental health is based on weak correlations and ignores a broad range of other factors, such as academic pressures, poverty, family instability, and exposure to violence. Remember the panic in the 1990s over video games and youth violence? We're looking again for the same easy solutions to hard problems. But the Internet was supposed to fix social isolation and fragmentation, said Yasha Monk in the Dispatch. Technologists claimed it would make us realize how much we have in common with those who are very different from us. Instead, the Internet has sparked a return to tribalism, made us less likely to socialize outside digital spaces, and left more people single and celibate, despite the endless stream of potential romantic matches on dating apps. The tools we built to connect us are, in practice, turning us into the worst versions of ourselves. And we should have time for two of the Talking Points articles. We'll start with Smithsonian, ordered to whitewash history. For President Trump, only a triumphalist version of history will do, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. His administration last week gave the Smithsonian Institution 120 days to review displays at eight national museums and replace divisive or ideologically driven language with material that celebrates American exceptionalism. We've already seen glimpses of what that looks like. Last month, the National Museum of American History removed references to Trump's impeachments from an exhibit. Those references were recently restored with changes. They no longer mention Trump's false statements about the 2020 election or how his January 6, 2021 speech encouraged the Capitol insurrection. Other inconvenient facts will soon disappear, said Renee Graham in the Boston Globe. Trump and his Project 2025 allies consider it unpatriotic to discuss this nation's history of racist subjugation, enslavement, and internment. They want an American story with just the good parts, especially those that deify this nation as one built by and for white people. If anyone's guilty of historical revisionism, it's the progressives who've been running America's museums, said National Review in an editorial. In recent years, the Smithsonian has infused ever more exhibits and educational materials with the idea that racist oppression and injustice are not just facets of our history, but a defining trait of America's character. The National Museum of African American History and Culture labeled rational thinking and hard work as aspects and assumptions of whiteness, and an exhibit for upcoming National Museum of the American Latino contains section after section on white colonization and racism. None of this means our museums should scrub mentions of slavery, segregation, or other national sins, but they should also showcase the tremendous sacrifices that millions of Americans made to defeat such injustices. If the administration gets this review right, the Smithsonian will again be a cultural gem that all Americans can take pride in. Trump has no interest in telling the history of all Americans, said Thomas Lecoq in The Bulwark. His administration has pushed the National Park Service to censor plaques that describe the brutally meted out against slaves and the Native Americans, and is reinstalling Jim Crow-era statues that whitewash the Confederacy. This attempt to present a flawless nation making an unbroken string of progress is really just a bedtime story for children, white children. It's not history, it's propaganda. Man-keeping, why women are fed up. Hey, ladies, have you been trapped into man-keeping your boyfriend or husband? Asked Emma Spector in Vogue. That's the new term for the widespread phenomenon of women assuming full responsibility for a couple's social life and serving as the only person their emotionally isolated male partner can confide in. Coined by Stanford University fellow Angelica Puzio-Ferrara, man-keeping describes the hard work a woman does to keep her less-than-motivated male partner from succumbing to the male loneliness epidemic. In 2021, 15% of men reported having zero close friends, up from 3% in 1990. Today, just 20% of men say they reach out to friends to discuss personal issues. That leaves women with the unreciprocated burden of meeting all of their partner's social and emotional needs, and planning get-togethers with friends like parents scheduling play dates for children. Providing emotional support is part of the deep and abiding joy of a loving relationship, said Kat Rosenfield in the Free Press. For decades, women complained that men were uncommunicative and deep in the grips of toxic masculinity. Man-keeping is downstream of a decades-long cultural consensus that men and masculinity are fundamentally defective. We mocked male social life, demonizing activities like fraternities and all-male clubs as bro culture. So now men are more dependent on women for emotional connection and social life. Apparently, when women said we wanted men to share their feelings, we didn't mean with us. Women, though, say it can be draining to meet all of a man's emotional needs, said Katherine Pearson in the New York Times. Some young women even say it's driven them to celibacy. Among single men, 61% are looking for a relationship, but just 38% of single women want one. These women are opting out because they are weary of the emotional labor of supporting their partners through daily challenges and encouraging them to meet up with their friends. Man-keeping may be an actual phenomenon, said Jesse Singal in his Substack newsletter, caused in part by the collapse of traditionally male civic institutions. like churches, bowling leagues, and veterans organizations. Still, the term is condescending. Most terms that end with keeping involve inanimate objects or animals, like housekeeping or beekeeping. Men are suffering from a genuine problem with social isolation. It doesn't help anyone to give their struggles a derisive name that makes them sound burdensome and not quite human. And a short note or two. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is planning to open or expand 125 immigration detention facilities this year, more than doubling capacity to about 108,000 beds by January. The plan calls for three new or expanded family facilities totaling more than 5,700 beds, suggesting the government is planning to increase deportations of parents along with their children. The share of Americans who say they drink alcohol has hit a record low of 54%, according to a new Gallup poll. That's a drop of 13 percentage points from 2022, and the lowest number since the pollster began tracking drinking in 1939. And we'll finish with two quotes. Desmond Tutu says, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor." And Bob Dylan says, "I accept chaos. I am not sure whether it accepts me." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.